Hello and welcome to episode 152 of Tea or Books. I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And today we are going to be starting off with looking at, do we prefer novels depicting women's domestic lives versus women's professional lives? Followed by looking at two novels about, well, one's about a professor, one's about a teacher, Men in Education. The Professor's House by Willa Cather and The Things We Never Say by Elizabeth Strout. Interestingly, two books by women with male protagonists.
That's true, actually. Yeah. Good
point. But first of all, Simon, how are you? What have you been up to? You've been overseas since we last recorded.
I have. It feels like such a long time ago now, but I did go to Canada, specifically to Calgary, Banff and Vancouver, all over vaguely west, I guess. There were definite highlights. There were some lowlights, but I'll stick with the highlights. I loved seeing Banff. I love seeing friend of the pod, Claire. Wow. We had lunch in Vancouver. She met my brother.
Lovely Claire.
And we decided to only take cabin luggage. We didn't have any hold luggage.
Okay.
So, even though I was there for 2 weeks and Colin was there for like a month. Mm-hmm. But I decided, because of that, I would only buy 5 books and I bought 16 books. So,
how did you get them home?
Well, I threw away some jeans. It's like I can get jeans back in the UK. They were on their, wait for it, last legs. But I was only buying books that I couldn't get easily in the UK and almost entirely Canadian authors. And I was very blessed by the bookshops that had separate shelves for Canadian authors. So yeah, I got some that I was particularly looking for and lots of serendipitous finds. I think my favorite of the, I've read quite a few of them already. I really liked Ordinary Wonder Tales by Emily Urquhart, which are like memoir essays comparing experiences from her life with folklore. And she's got a PhD in folklore.
Yeah.
And absolutely fascinating. Her mum, Jane Urquhart, is also a well-known Canadian novelist. I bought one of her books, but I've not read that yet. I really recommend that. You can see a full review of that on my blog. And it was a Canadian small press as well. So I think probably very easy to get in Canada, maybe not so easy to get elsewhere.
Well, you know, I think when you are going somewhere and you're wanting to collect books you can't get elsewhere, I think you're justified in going beyond your limit.
I think so.
Yeah.
Colin was like, none of this is true. Like I kept saying, I'm not going to buy any more books now. And he'd be like, I think that's true, but I know it's not. I was like, Colin knows me better than I know myself.
Yeah. Okay. But you know, I can justify to the fact that Canadian novels are hard to find in the UK. American novels, no, but Canadian for sure. Same with Australia.
Yeah, so, it's true.
Yeah. So, uncharacteristically, I am supporting your acceptance.
It's true. Yeah. My goodness. I need to take advantage of this. No, well, I don't know how I can't get any more right now. I'm not, no longer there. But yeah, all the ones, I think I read 5 or 6 of those 16 so far, and they've all been really good. One bookshop I went into and I just said, I want to read Canadian novels about Canadian life that I can't get in the UK. And it was, and the bookseller just took me around and just piled things into my hands, and I bought quite a few of them. So thank you to the lovely booksellers in Pages Books in Kensington, Calgary.
Sounds lovely.
Also, there's a cat there, so that was a good bookshop.
Oh, well, I bet they loved you when you came in.
I know, it's a fun thing to be asked, isn't it? And they didn't really ask anything about my taste. So like, I don't know what they were basing these recommendations on particularly, but the one I had read was called Prairie Edge by Connor Kerr, which is set in Alberta. It's not in Calgary, but set in Edmonton, about some Métis people who release bison into downtown Alberta as a sort of protest. Sorry, downtown Edmonton. And I really enjoyed that. It was very good.
Sounds fascinating. Well, I'm very glad. Well done.
Thank you. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm on week 3 of summer holidays. So I've had lots of time to read, and as I was just telling you, I've had this pile of guilt books on my desk at work for months, where colleagues keep giving me books to read, and I'm like, oh great, yeah, thanks, and just haven't had time to read them. So I felt like I really had to get through all of these. I cleared my desk at the end of the school year, and I was like, right, you have somehow managed to amass a pile of 10 books that you need to read as possible. So I've read a lot of contemporary stuff. The best of the bunch, I would say, was probably what was that book that I told you about just now, whose name I can't remember?
Oh, the one we're doing next time, when the cranes fly south.
When the Cranes Fly South, which is a Swedish novel, and it's about an old man who's in his late 80s. He's living alone. His wife has got dementia and she's had to go into a home, and it's his son wants to take his dog away from him, and says he can't be responsible for it anymore. And you kind of get this first person perspective really of what it's like to be an older person and to gradually have your agency removed. And it sounds incredibly depressing. It's not. It's just very beautiful and profound in that way that I find Scandinavian novels often are, very really connected to the landscape as well, which I really enjoyed. And I just thought to myself, you know, I don't think I've actually read a book from the perspective of somebody like at the end of their life, you know, in terms of not necessarily like I have with people who've got terminal illness and stuff, but not somebody who's 90 and knows that at some point they're going to die fairly soon, though there's no, they're not ill or anything. And yeah,
I guess Gilead is the other example, but
yes,
yes.
no, that's a good no, but he does have his heart illness, doesn't he? So he knows he could
That's
get
true, yeah. Could triggered, yes, I know what you
yeah.
mean.
Whereas, and I just found it very, very beautiful. I really enjoyed the reading experience, and I was kind of wishing that I'd read it before and hadn't left it on my desk for 6 months. And I also just read The Bee Sting by Paul something
Murray.
Murray, yes, thank you, which again, which has been on my desk at work for a year, everybody. Terrible. My desk is chaos. My home is very tidy, as you can attest to, Simon, having been there. But my work desk is like just chaos. And the fact that this book was on my desk for a year under a pile of other things, this says everything. And I didn't read it last summer because I thought, oh, it's too long and I don't know if I'm going to like this. But I could not put it down. Absolutely brilliant. So clever. Hated the ending because I didn't want the ending to be the ending. And had a very good discussion with a friend about that the other day. He was like, "Well, maybe we can interpret differently." I was like, "We can't interpret it differently. Look at the beginning." And it's, yeah, absolutely brilliant. An Irish family saga, really interesting, and a quite like the each chapter is told from the perspective of a different character, and the writing style is very different for each character to reflect the way that they think and interact with the world, which I thought was incredibly clever. And being able to get into the head of teenage boy, teenage girl, adult woman, adult man, elderly people, etc. I just thought it was brilliant. I absolutely loved it.
Okay, I gave it to my best friend a while ago, but I haven't read it. I just asked her husband what books he thought she might like. So that's
Think you'd
the
like
reason I read it.
it,
Okay, well, keep it. Maybe I'll borrow it back from her.
actually. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those books that you look at and you think, 600 pages, have I got the patience, stamina, etc.?
Yeah.
But it's, I was sitting there and comfortably reading 150 pages in one go. Like, you literally can't put it down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of doorstoppers, on the question and answer episode, thanks so much, everyone who sent those in again. I mentioned that I'd never read Middlemarch, and someone, I think it was Brian, put in the comments like he also never has, and he challenged me to read it this
Oh.
year with, and he would too. So I think that's my goal. My only reading goal for 2026 is to actually read Middlemarch.
I
So
think
there you
I've read
go.
it several times, and because I had to for various educational reasons, and I thoroughly enjoy it.
Okay, maybe we'll do an episode in Middlemarch later in the year to make me
Maybe
actually
I'll
read
read it.
it.
Maybe I'll read it again as well, Simon.
Okay,
Maybe we all
watch
should.
this space, watch this
Yeah.
face. He did, after all, become voted the best novel of all time or whatever recently. And in fact, was we can come obviously come into this later, but it was mentioned in an episode on Take Four Books on Radio Four by Elizabeth Strout as one of the inspirations for Things We
Oh,
Never Say. So there
there we are.
you go.
Though I do take great umbrage at that list that said Middlemarch was the best novel because Emma was, you know, behind. But quite frankly, how you could vote Middlemarch better than Emma, I don't know.
No, impossible. So yeah, thank you, Lindy, for suggesting this topic for the first half of Do We Prefer Reading About Women's Domestic Lives or Their Professional Lives. Well, let's start with any interesting professions we've read about, maybe.
Well, one of my all-time favorite middlebrow novels is High Wages by Dorothy Whipple. And the reason why I love that book so much is because it's all about a woman who has her own dress shop. And you see the development because it's set in the kind of late Edwardian period going into the 20s, I think. You see the development of the initial, she works in the sort of haberdashers and people coming in to buy the fabric and the trimming to make up their own dresses. And then she starts to see the trend for ready-made becoming much more popular. And then she branches out and eventually creates her own dress shop where she's going out on all of these trips to source clothes and things. And the enjoyment and pleasure and pride and sense of achievement she gets, not only in running her own successful business, but also that, I suppose, creative fulfillment in the fashion industry and that enjoyment of making people look good in the clothes that they wear. I just thought it was brilliant. And I loved the fact that it was one of the first books I've ever read, actually, that showed a woman's life with the focus being on her career and her personal interests rather than on the desire to get married or having a romantic relationship.
Yeah, I was thinking about different jobs that I read about, and that one came up to mind as well. And I could think quite a few that are in shops. So it's like the flower shop is sort of from home in The Lark by E. Nesbitt. There's Hat Shop and Economy Must Be Our Watchword by Joyce Dennis, which I love. The second two books in the L-Shaped Room trilogy, there's I think it's an antique shop. I've read those books so many times and I can't remember. But and I thought, yeah, the shop is an interesting sort of compromise between these places because whilst it obviously is a professional environment, there's something also, I guess, curiously domestic, particularly about a shop that has furniture or fabric or clothing as a main thing. So those are such domestic objects, but it's also a place where they're not holed away in an office somewhere. There are, you know, it gives a good opportunity for different characters to arrive and all those sorts of things. I was thinking Pindacy of Heap Show as well. That's got lots in a shop, hasn't it? So shop came up a lot, and I was trying to think of the more unusual ones and whether I enjoy those. And I've recently read a really interesting and really good book called The Friend in Need by Elizabeth Coxhead, which was published, I think, in the 50s or maybe 60s, where the main character is a social worker. Yeah. And that's something I've never read a novel about before. And I went in slightly nervously because I thought, goodness knows what social work was like in that period. And I'm sure that her approach involved things that would be anathema to social workers today. But I actually thought it had a lot of respect for the working class children characters in it, which I was worried there would not be, and respect for quite a lot of their parents as well, or other guardians. And also, but by the way, one of the most sort of adorable romance storylines that I've come across in quite a long time between that's the author, I can't remember the character's name, but this very sort of upper middle class social worker with a lower middle / working class man that who thinks he can't possibly be good enough for her, and she thinks he's lovely, and it's all very sweet. So really recommend that. I'm hoping, I've recommended it to the British Library to come out in the series, so fingers crossed. But I thought, yeah, that's such an interesting profession to write about, because again, it gives you an opportunity to introduce lots of secondary or temporary characters and lots of scenarios that are very people based in a way that, you know, a data entry job or something wouldn't be. Yes. But also just a fascinating insight into presumably well-informed version of what that particular job was like 70 plus years ago.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most interesting things about certainly reading novels that aren't set now that are based on people's professions, because you get to see the reality of how these sorts of jobs change over time, how attitudes towards people change over time as well. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love Fresh from the Country by Miss Reed, which is set in a primary school, the teacher and the young teacher coming into this job for the first time. And so much of it is recognisable, but then you've also got the reality that it's perfectly normal for her to have a class of 50 students. And it's like, oh, okay, when you think that like teaching is really hard work and isn't it terrible, and how, and people say, oh, you know, it wasn't like this when we were at school. It's like, actually it was worse. So it gives you that bit of perspective really, and helps you to understand how professions change and grow over time. But that's a wonderful depiction of working life. And as Miss Reed, the author, was a teacher herself, it's also very well informed. I'm wondering, with your book about social work, how much, like, how she found out about the profession. Was she a social worker herself? Did she do research, or do you know, does it say?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a really obscure book. It was one that I just bought in Hay on Wye, sort of because it looked interesting. And there is a small blurb about her, but I don't remember it saying that she has first-hand experience. Yeah, I don't know, but it's only, I mean, to me, it felt authentic, but what do I know? Yeah. I think that can be the problem potentially with this, with the sort of job focused book, is if the author doesn't know anything about it, then either it reads as inauthentic to people who do know about it, or it ends up being like an exercise in dumping research, which, I mean, I know we covered it and I thought it was okay, but Lessons in Chemistry, that everyone raved about so much, yeah, which I didn't love as much as other people did feel very like, here is a TV chef, here is a scientist, here are my, you know, here's my research about that, sort of, but also doesn't relate on the page like either of those professions would actually be. And sometimes it can just be a bit self-consciously quirky. So it is sort of a fine line between, here is an unusual, I love reading about unusual professions, but I don't want it to feel like sort of a half-hearted biography or something that clearly they don't have the first idea about what that job actually is like.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think for me as well, I really like books that explore the challenges of professional life, and I'm not necessarily bothered about, you know, understanding the ins and outs of what somebody does for their jobs. But one of the reasons why I love Barbara Pym's novels so much is that so many of the characters in there work in these really kind of dead end secretarial office jobs that they hate, and you see all of the office politics behind the scenes. And it's not about the work that they're doing, it's about the environment of the office, and then also that exploration of what it's like to be a working woman who lives alone, you know, yes, because most of her heroines, you know, they're not married, they don't have children. And the juggling of going to work, then having to get your food on the way home. And it's still, even though those books were written in the kind of mid-century, it's still a very recognisable portrait of the pressures of working life and how much crap you have to put up with from colleagues and so on. And also interesting from a feminist perspective to look at the discrepancy in the roles in those novels. You know, all of the women are secretaries, all the positions of responsibility are dominated by men, and the kinds of inappropriate comments or inappropriate expectations of the women put on them by the men. You know, oh, can you go out and get my lunch for me? Can you go out and pick up my dry cleaning? Oh, can you go and sort this out for me? It's like, she's not your personal assistant, she's just a secretary in the office. But the expectation is that the women are there, no matter what their job is, to service the men, essentially. So I find all of that very interesting. And there's lots of mid-century novels that explore that kind of thing. I mean, there's a little bit of it in Muriel Spark, and I think as well, oh God, it's gone out of my head, the novel that we read, she retires and then has the diary and...
Five-year sentence, Bernice Rubens.
Yeah, 5-year sentence. And again, that's almost Pym-esque situation. I mean, I thought it was going to be like Barbara Pym, and then obviously went in a very...
Yes.
but it's that sort of environment I find very interesting. And I like probably reading more novels, mid-century novels set in those kinds of professional environments than I do domestic environments, because the domestic environment is the norm, I suppose, rather than something that, and I don't feel like, certainly most of the mid-century novels I read and have read are middle to upper class settings, so you're getting the same background of servant problems or you know, not having to do the housework yourself and those kinds of issues that, you know, you tend to feel a little bit outdated.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess it's easier somehow to think of the books that do have professions in, because mm-hmm. there's such an amorphous mass of particularly, yeah, as you say, early, mid-20th century or indeed earlier books where, you know, the Ebb Delafields or Ivy Contraband or Elizabeth Taylor or all these other people where it's sort of taken for granted. I know there will be exceptions amongst their output, but broadly, those characters are not going to have to work for a private income. Or rather, they already have an independent income. And as you say, that covers a huge array of types of book. And yet, whilst you can have infinite variety within a domestic life, it's you're not going to a novel thinking, oh, interesting, this novel's about a housewife or, you know, an upper middle class woman who didn't have to work or something. It's more just that's the background we've taken as read, what happens next. Yeah. So I do love that sort of novel, but it feels a bit harder to categorize it because it feels sort of like the default from the beginning of the time the novel was written up until about 1950 or something.
Interesting
sort of not counterpoint, but like interesting comparison to what you've been saying about how women are often the more lowly characters in an office or something in these novels, is how surprisingly early women were GPs and some interesting novels there, like Dangerous Ages by Rose McCauley has a GP. I'm sure Helen Ashton, I know she wrote about male doctors. Did she write about female doctors as well? I can't remember. But I've read a handful at least of those novels, and it always comes as a sort of very pleasant surprise that women were able to be doctors long before they were welcomed into many other professions. And interesting to read from that perspective.
Yes, and I mean, there's a lot of 50s and 60s novels in particular, slightly trashy ones that are told through, explore nurse novels, aren't they, with women as nurses in that kind of medical setting. But I don't think I've read or seen one about a female doctor, but I'm sure they must exist.
Oh, well, you must read Dangerous Ages then. It's great.
Okay, I will.
And then there's Monica Dickens, very funny. I guess they're not novels. They are sort of fictionalized memoirs or something where she becomes a cook and then becomes a nurse and then becomes a journalist in my, is it called? One Pair of Hands, One Pair of Feet and My Tent to Make the Tea.
Yes.
Which I don't think she's playing for verisimilitude. It's definitely exaggerated, but they are great fun.
And there's plenty of novels with women as artists and actresses and so on, which are all
those do seem to be the go-to, don't they? I guess they're the things that were acceptable for genteel women.
Yes.
Maybe not actress, but like artist and writer, and were acceptable professions.
Yes. Illyrian Spring, she's an artist, which one of my favourite books. And who can forget our favourite Catherine Carter?
Of course, yes.
So yeah, there's lots. I think it's interesting as well. One of the reasons why I'm just thinking of South Riding by Winifred Holtby, which I know is not your favourite. That's a wonderful book at looking at a variety of women in professions and social professions in particular. You've got a head teacher, you've got politicians, you've got counsellors, etc., justice of the peace, and so on. So women who are in positions of political power, which in the 1930s they were really this has been the culmination of a lot of work to get themselves into those positions, and it's really interesting to see the reality of what that was like.
Interesting is one word for that novel. Yes, boring is another one, but yeah,
it's a wonderful tapestry of modern life. And I don't know why you don't love it.
So tedious. Speaking of acting, I'm currently reading Carol by Patricia Highsmith.
Oh,
have you read that?
I have, yes.
Yeah. In fact, it has sort of both. It has one woman who is who doesn't need to work, and the other one who is originally a shop assistant, and that's how the working class and the upper class women meet. But I think more interesting from the career point of view is that she while she's not working in a shop, is a theatre designer. And I thought, you know, it doesn't play a huge role in the novel, but I was really interested even in the little snippets we got about her making the models as prototypes of the set, and then the feedback from the director, and also all things that I'm sure you know in your theatrical world now. But yeah. I don't know if it's done the same way. I imagine more computers are involved than used to be. But yeah, I enjoyed those details. I thought, it sort of made the novel feel a little less stereotypical of like working class shop girl meets upper class woman in furs sort of vibe. But and yeah, gave more nuance. To be honest, I'm finding the novel a bit of a drag. I did really enjoy the first sort of half, and I've just find that there's very little sort of momentum to it now. But did you like it?
I did. But I think I'd watch the film first, so maybe.
Oh, I've not seen it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I probably enjoyed the film more than the book. And I think because I read the book after the film, I maybe filled in some stuff from what I'd seen. So I don't know. I'm not reliable on that one. It's been a long time.
Well, my book group is doing it tomorrow, so I'll discuss it more then. Although slim pickings based on who is not watching the football match.
So. Yeah, I mean, what are you thinking? I'll certainly be watching it.
Will you? under no circumstances would I watch that or any other football match. because you don't know when we're recording, tomorrow is the semi-final of the World Cup.
Semi-final of the World Cup for England. So yeah, England versus Argentina. We'll see how we get on.
I hope never to find out.
But the thing is, where I live, I'm surrounded by so many pubs. I don't even need to watch. I can just hear from the shouting what's happening.
Right. Funny. Well, shall we make our decision? I know we've talked more about jobs than domestic, yes. But I think that is because they are a little more distinct, perhaps. But, yes. Women's domestic lives or women's professional lives? What are you going to go for?
I think as a professional woman myself, I enjoy reading about women's professional lives through time.
Yeah, yeah. I think it would draw me like the Elizabeth Coxhead social work novel. I think particularly if it's an unusual profession, I'd be like, oh, I would like to find out more about that or see how the author's treated that. So I'm going to be with you. Yeah. Professional lives. Do let us know any recommendations for unusual women's professions in novels. Let us know at teaorbooks@gmail.com. We'd love the suggestions. Shannon has a question for the middle section, which is, what were the first adult books you read, and how do you think those first reads influence the books you prefer now?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to have to think about that because I'm not sure.
I can start if you like. Yeah. I think the first adult book I read was 1984, when I was maybe 13. And that was around the same time that I really got into Agatha Christie. So I read a lot of those. Like a lot of people, I think, have that as their jumping off point. But I don't know why 1984. It was in our school library. Someone must have mentioned it. And I mean, I still love 1984 and I still love Agatha Christie. But I think, how did it influence what I read now? I think 1984 gave me an appreciation for excellent writing that is not super showy. And Agatha Christie gave me an appreciation for compelling plots, I suppose. So I think probably it was more than adult novels that I read when I was maybe a couple years older than that, that really set me off in a particular direction. But I think maybe, yeah, it gave me an appreciation for simplicity in writing, and it hopefully stopped me being a snob about authors like Agatha Christie, because I'm like, I can appreciate fine writing, but I can also appreciate the genius it takes to plot as well as she does.
Wow. I can't actually remember the first books I was given. I feel like it was probably Daphne du Maurier. And I remember my mum buying me Rebecca and My Cousin Rachel, and I really loved those. And then she got me onto Jane Austen from there, but I did struggle with Jane Austen at first. I think I started reading Jane Austen when I was about 13, and I think I found the language a bit too much. So I didn't come back to them for another couple of years. But I was a voracious reader of all sorts, but I think but when I went to secondary school, I think that my mum was trying to kind of push me away from my Babysitter's Club stuff, my preference. You did Sweet Valley High, didn't you? I was a
babysitter. That's right. Yeah.
And moving me on to more adult stuff. But I think it's, yeah, I remember vividly reading Rebecca and My Cousin Rachel. I must have been about 12, and really loving those. And then it was very much going straight from there on to Austen and the Brontes. I read Jane Eyre quite young as well, probably 13. Loved that, absolutely loved it. So yeah, big old classics. And I think for me, it set a kind of precedent for me that I could read anything I wanted, and I wasn't limited by things having to be a certain length or appropriateness for me. My mum was very liberal. I just used to go, I wouldn't really have any books at home, so I would just go to the library and I'd be allowed to choose whatever I wanted. So and I had a very good English teacher as well at that age, who gave me lots of things to read. So I think it definitely for me made me challenge myself and read. My main diet at that age, and really up until my mid-20s, was a lot of it was classics. And that's interesting. I think that's because that's as being good literature.
Yeah, I mean, it's not adult literature, but what you said there, it reminds me, I'm so grateful that my parents let me read whatever I want. Because you could get parents who think, oh, why is this boy reading like Goosebumps and Point Horror and Sweet Valley and all this like trashy nonsense, and you should read something improving. But I think my parents are just like, he's loving reading, that's great, let him, he'll get out of his system and he'll read good books eventually. So, and it worked out.
I mean, all reading is good reading, that's what I always say.
Yeah absolutely.
Yeah
So I'm sure lots of parents would love that kids to be reading anything. So thanks, Shannon. If you've got a question, we've sort of exhausted all our other questions now in the big Q&A episode. Normally I've got a bit of a backlog, so any questions for the middle section, do let us know, teyourbooks@gmail.com. So on to two novels, The Professor's House by Willa Cather and The Things We Never Say by Elizabeth Strout. Any preference for which you introduce us to?
I just finished The Professor's House this morning, so that's freshest in my mind.
Great. Do you want to kick us off then with that?
Okay, so The Professor's House by Willa Cather is a novel about Godfrey St. Peter, whose name is actually hilariously Napoleon. And he is a professor in a Midwestern town on Lake Michigan. Is that where they live?
Maybe.
And in the, do you know, I didn't even really get a sense of when it was. Was it the 20s or 30s?
20s. Well, that's a good question. 25 it was published, yeah.
Yeah, so it's after World War One anyway, but not World War Two yet. And he's a professor of history, and he, at the beginning of the novel, he's in his 50s, and he's always lived a very simple life with his wife and two daughters. But he's recently, it's taken him years and years and years to write this history of the Spanish adventurers in America. And he's suddenly become really famous off the back of this work that he's done. And he's won this big prize, and with it has come a lot of money, and he's built a new house. But he's very attached to his old house and in the study in there. And he doesn't actually want to leave. And so what this period in his life leads to is this kind of introspective discovery as he's kind of working out what he really values and what he really wants. And alongside that is the story of Tom Outland, who was his daughter's fiance, who died during World War One. That's not a spoiler because you find out straight away. And we find out that this boy was working alongside the professor, and they had this very close student mentor relationship, and Tom Outland developed some kind of gas that bit was a bit beyond me, as I don't know. This gas that has gone on to become patented by his son-in-law, who married the daughter who was engaged to Tom Outland, and they've made an absolute fortune as a result. So there's also the the problems within the family of the fact that there's one daughter, he's now the equivalent of a multimillionaire, and the other daughter, he doesn't have any money at all. And that's also created problems for Godfrey, because he feels that he's kind of failed as a parent in some way. So yeah, it's a very interesting novel from that sense, and it's kind of got two narratives, because you've got Godfrey, but then towards the end you've also got a big chunk of Tom Outland's diary as well, so you get to hear about his life in New Mexico. Yeah.
So The Things We Never Say is a very recent novel, came out a couple months ago, with another man in education, as you say, Artie Dam. Another bizarrely named man. Artie Dam is a, I guess, late middle age high school history teacher in Massachusetts. And it's basically about his professional and family life, to link it to the first half. So it's about what it's like to teach history in 2024, I think it's that. But yes, because the election, the most recent US election, comes in the middle of it. And what's, you know, what life is like for students who've been through COVID and living in a bizarre political world, but also about his family life. He's got a wife, Evie, he's been married to for many, many years, but doesn't fully know or understand her. He's got a son, Rob, who they were once very close, now again quite distant in some ways, because Rob is sort of haunted by his girlfriend dying in a car accident that I shan't go into details of what was happening during the car accident, but it was something he was ashamed of. There is a big twist in it, which we're not going to give away, but I think it's a really interesting novel about professional and private life. And Archie Dam is a really interesting character. And there is actually, you know, these novels are written 100 years apart, but I think quite a lot of overlap in what it's like to be like a family man and educator, and the sort of different tensions and stresses that they face whilst not fully understanding those around them.
Yes. I think it was, if we go to Elizabeth Strout first, as she's talked about it, I mean, as you know, I'm an enormous fan. I've read everything she's written, and I was super excited for this one to come out, and especially as the main character's a teacher. And I found the depiction of teaching to be incredibly accurate. And I think she teaches at university, perhaps does a bit of creative writing teaching, but I don't, as far as I know, she's never been a high school teacher. So I don't know where she got that accuracy from, but it felt very true to me. And a lot of the portrayals of his relationship with the students and some of the things he worries about, particularly there's a female student who's very vulnerable and he feels a huge amount of concern for her. I mean, I found that very touching and very recognizable. And also the complexities of teaching now, when there's so many political uncertainties, the children are worried about so many things, and also we're increasingly in an environment where, as teachers, we're not allowed to say things, we're not allowed to show an allegiance to a particular political viewpoint, and it is very charged, much more so in America than it is here. And so I really felt for him as a person who has put everything into his job, and he's now entering into a phase, you know, he's edging towards retirement, and he's finding that the circumstances of the world in which he's living, he can no longer do the job that he loves anymore. And that profound sadness I found really moving. And then alongside this, I mean, I thought that opening was brilliant, with this him being at this party and realizing, you know, nobody ever actually says anything that means anything, and how that dovetails into his professional problems and then his relationship with his wife and so on. I just thought was really powerful.
Yeah. I was going to ask how authentic it was, because obviously I've never been a teacher, but it's good to know that it is so authentic and realistic. And I thought it was, there's interesting things that feel very contemporary, like, for years and years and years, he's got people in the, or students in the class, to research actual Massachusetts soldiers and nurses, who, I don't know anything about the American Civil War, but I guess Massachusetts was a Union state. So that's my assumption based on the novel. Correct me if I'm wrong. But so they've always written to people who happened to be, because they were from Massachusetts, on one particular side of the Civil War. And now he's getting teachers saying, why aren't you writing to Confederates? Or doing, getting them to write to Confederate soldiers and nurses. And yeah, things like that, they're very precise, but it's a very political novel. Elizabeth Strout, I assume, shares the politics of Artie Dam based on the way she writes. It's very, you don't come away wondering what party Elizabeth Strout votes for, I would say. Yeah. It's very clear.
Yeah.
Which, since I share her political feelings, I have no problem with, but I imagine might feel slightly off-putting or simplistic to someone who doesn't share those feelings. But at the same time, it does feel increasingly like supporting one particular politician at the moment is anti-empathy in the way that Elizabeth Strout in all her novels is invested, all the ones I've read, is always on the side of empathy. Whereas I think there's certainly elements in the professor's house where I think he says he's just not going to bother learning the names of everyone at one point, or his new students at one point. He's just tired of it. And obviously teaching in university 100 years ago is different from teaching in a high school now. But I believed some of the peripheries of what it was like to work in education then. I think any excerpts we saw of things he was saying in the classroom felt quite fake. It felt quite like sort of manufactured speeches in the way that I don't think anyone's ever spoken in or out of a classroom. So occasionally she would lean into like, here is the mouthpiece for this particular viewpoint or something. Like when he was talking about art and religion together, and it's like, this is an essay. This is not something that people say out loud. So that felt a bit jarring.
Yes, but I thought it was interesting. And I agree with you on that. I was like, oh, I don't think I've ever been this articulate in the classroom, especially not when put on the spot by a student. But I found it interesting that he was saying about how him and other people in his department had found themselves at odds with other colleagues over the commercialization of education. You know, the university. Mm. Accepting credits in other subjects to basically shore up their finances, and thinking this is the 1920s, and when we think of this as being a modern problem, that oh, you're dumbing down courses and you're doing a course in something that doesn't have any academic value in order to try and get more students in, and that contributed to his sense of malaise about his profession, because he's got students in the classroom who don't want to be there and have no interest in what he's got to teach, and I think that really kind of very close comparison to the themes of both novels, considering they're written 100 years apart, was incredible to see.
Yeah, the integrity of the person who's there because they love education versus the apparatus of a school as a political or financial organization was, as you say, like really surprising that there's such a through line. Because I think if Godfrey and Artie were to meet each other and have a drink together, they'd have so much to talk about. And that'd be such fascinating. Really. Yeah, so much in common as well.
Yeah.
So something surprising they have in common in both novels is thinking about killing themselves, which is, again, a comparison I did not expect to see. That's, I guess, slightly a spoiler, but it comes relatively early in one of the two novels, which... in both of them felt not necessarily jarring, because it didn't feel like it was unearned or if it was like it was gratuitous, but it did feel like, oh, ordinary people can feel such a sort of swell of dissatisfaction that this feels like an option they should take, or hopelessness maybe, because neither of them have terrible lives on the outside. And if they were to end their lives, then you would imagine that their communities would be astonished. But yeah, I thought that both, it was handled sensitively and interestingly by both the authors, and possibly more controversial in Willa Cather's day than in Elizabeth Strout's.
Yeah, I think that depiction of male mental health was very interesting. And, you know, statistically, men are always more likely to commit suicide than women. That idea as well of, well, people always say, oh, well, you know, if somebody's depressed, you don't. And that kind of very sensitive portrayal of both men who, to the outside eye, have these very perfect, successful lives. You know, they both have what looks like very happy marriages. They're both parents of children who are successful. they've both had long, successful careers, but getting to a point in their life where they feel like, what is the point of everything that I've done, or what actual value is this? And I think what's interesting about both of the men is how profoundly lonely they both were, despite having wives and friends and children. There was that lack of true connection to other people, and also a true connection with themselves. Neither of them felt that they were living authentically. And I found that very interesting, both in Elizabeth Strout's novel, because I think that's a very current debate that we're having. But I found it so surprisingly contemporary to read in The Professor's House.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And as you say, these marriages that, you know, the professor is still using the house that they lived in before they inherited all this money, and he's clearly wants that separation. But there is that sense of separation that seems to come more of a surprise to Artie, that he's like, oh, I don't actually understand my wife as well as I thought I did. And in both novels, I really appreciated looking at them as fathers as well. I loved the evolving relationship between Artie and his son, Rob. And, you know, truths that become uncovered and like miscommunication that sort of gets cleared up. I thought it was really beautiful. And in the Professor's House, he's sort of like a middleman between these two daughters who, it's not like all out war, but yeah, as you say, one of them's very, very wealthy. The other one is not. And there is sort of envy and dissatisfaction between the two. But when the rich one tries to help the poorer one, that's also not received well. And I loved all the family stuff. I will say, in The Professor's House, I love the family stuff. I did not care for the sort of dumping of a whole different novella in the middle of it. Because as you say, it goes into this novella about Tom Outland that apparently was written first. So she wrote that, and then she decided to do the rest of the book as a sort of bookend to it. And it's him you know, going from very poor man to like evolving in this academic stuff, but also going on this, Hello, we just had a little unexpected break. I was recording at work after hours, and the cleaners needed to lock up, bless them. So they threw me out. We abruptly ended. But we picked it up later in the evening, and hopefully we won't repeat ourselves too much. So yeah, I was saying that I really enjoyed the domestic stuff in the Professor's House, and I didn't love the Tom Outland sort of section sort of dumped in the middle, because it goes into first person from him, and then it goes back to the professor at the end. Sorry, there's a plane flying very low over me, so you can probably pick that up. And apparently Willa Cather wrote that novella first as a separate novella, and then wrote the rest as a framing device. So what did you mind about that? Was it okay for you?
I mean, I enjoyed reading it because I was fascinated by the description of him finding this hidden city in the Mesa? How do we say that?
Oh, I'd have said Mesa, but I wouldn't swear to it.
Yeah, I don't know. Which I mean, I was really into, actually, but I agree that it's kind of like, why are we being given this person's story here? Doesn't really make any sense. And I thought it was interesting as a concept to have this kind of person who had an enormous impact on characters within the novel and on their relationships with each other, but who is a sort of absent presence. I don't know whether us reading about his story gave us any more of an insight into the characters in the present day's lives, or why he'd had such an impact on them.
Yeah, I think I would have preferred him as an absence rather than the section in the middle is, as you say, him discovering this like hidden clifftop city sort of thing. That's quite a lot of fun on that. It also gives you a bit of a run up to his adolescence and his progression in his scientific career and all that sort of thing. But I never really liked framed narratives. I just feel it like kills the momentum. And even with something like Tenant of Wildfowl Hall, which I love in theory, with the actual reading process, I'm like, oh, we've suddenly gone into a 200 page diary or whatever it is, letters, I forget. I like books to continue as they begin in format.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. And I actually read this 22 years ago, I think, and I didn't remember anything about it apart from the opening scene.
How interesting.
Because I was like, I was trying to think when I picked it up, like, what is this book about? What I remember is the description of his room, which is the opening scene. I don't remember a single thing about the rest, except I always remember what I think of a book, and I remembered not loving it. And that always surprised me, because since then I've loved a lot of Willa Cather novels. And reading this time, I think I would have loved it if it had just been the beginning and the end sections, and it would have been a shorter book. And I think she's really good at really short books. We've done A Lost Lady twice by mistake. My Mortal Enemy, Alexandra's Bridge, all sorts of really good, really short novels. I've actually not read any of her longer books, like My Engineer or Song of the Lark. I don't know if you've read those, but I think she's really good at brevity.
I've read most of her books, and actually I've read all of her longer ones, and I think she's brilliant. And so I, even though I agree with you that the structure is awkward, and, you know, if you wanted to write a book about Tom Outland, then just do that. You know, I don't know why you felt the need to wrap it in something else. But nonetheless, I still very much enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the writing style. And, you know, I've never read about hidden Indian Native American cities in mesas before. I didn't even know what a mesa was. I had to look it up. I was like, brilliant, I've learned something. So I enjoyed that exploration of the landscape, that part of America, as a landscape I've never visited. So it took me on a nice imaginative journey. I mean, it didn't bother me, but at the same time, it didn't have a sense of continuity in the way that the Elizabeth Strout novel very much did. You know, we were reading very much a continuous narrative that, even though it moves forward in time, it kind of feels very cohesive, and you are following one person's journey through a set period of their life. You know, we don't know enough about Tom Outland to, I guess, to care, or maybe to feel invested in his story.
Yeah, I felt it did feel awkward, is a good word, because it had gone from this really intriguing presence that all the other characters had strong feelings about, but the reader didn't really know what he was actually like. I found a slightly underwhelming character when he actually came, just, I guess, because he was so definite after, and like no one can live up to that many, like, that much mythologizing about him when they actually appear.
Yeah, and I think actually it would have been more effective to be a bit Shakespearean with it and just leave him off stage, you know?
Yeah. And interesting what you said about the structure of the things we never say, because, it does have those few moments where it suddenly leaps forward and tells you how characters died, which I found really interesting. It's very like Muriel Spark thing. And in a not particularly experimental narrative other than that, but just, and only happened two or three times, and it shouldn't work, but for me it really did work. I think because it was so related to character, like the way that these people had died, or the way people thought about them when they died or reacted, was so like about character. It wasn't about shocking you with something quirky or something strange or a twist or something. It was just like, oh, this tells us so much about this person and how other people related to them. So it was bold, but I think it really worked.
Yeah, I know, I agree. And I found it really powerful, because what she was using that to do was to show the effect of the circumstances that were, you know, impacting these characters and these communities. And I think, you know, her portrayal of the political impact on education, and therefore the impact on educators, how that manifests in people's sense of self, in the sense of attachment to their career, and what that means for them as individuals, I thought was really powerful. And I think it's a really powerful exploration of male mental health as well, as I said before, and how things that we perhaps think don't affect people that much actually do, especially when somebody's job is a huge part, and perhaps the only part of their identity that matters to them.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you highlighted earlier in the episode that they're both books by women which are about men, and I've already forgotten if The Things We Never Say is in the first person. Is it? I can't remember.
No, I don't think it is.
No, so neither of them are the first person, but they are both like focalizing through these men. Well, I was going to ask you if you thought it worked. Can you judge that? I don't know.
I mean, I don't know what a man's voice would be like, being not being a man myself. But I think, to me, it felt convincing in both counts. I mean, I didn't feel like I was reading a false character, or it didn't feel fabricated or manufactured in any way. I thought there was sensitivity to the portrayals and a realism to them, but I don't know. I mean, you tell me, did it read like men to you?
Yes, I always feel wary of being the voice, the spokesperson for men, but
you must speak for them all.
Yeah, it certainly felt authentic. I can't remember if we talked about this when we did The Dutch House by Ann Patchett, but that's the only example I can think of recently where the man's voice just didn't work as a man, because it always felt like a woman. Whereas these, I never doubted that they were authentic men's voices. And I guess because they're both quite like sensitive men and surrounded by strong females in their lives, and it's not like she's, I think maybe where it'd be tricky is if you're trying to describe an all male environment, which I again have relatively little familiarity with, but I think it would be hard to write, you know, about a locker room or something if you're a female writer. But I think these sorts of worlds, I increasingly believe that people should be able to write whatever narratives they want, as long as there's equal opportunities in the publishing industry for everyone to get published. And obviously in this case, we don't need to worry about the men getting published.
I agree. And I think it's very limiting to suggest that you can't imaginatively enter the headspace of someone different to you. And I mean, that would also be saying that every character anyone ever wrote was exactly the same as them. So that would be absurd. Mm-hmm. But I do wonder whether using the third person as opposed to the first person helps somewhat in creating that convincing voice. I really enjoyed, as you know, I often tend to read books by women about women, just as a, I guess it's like, it's not even a choice often, it's just instinctive. I don't necessarily actively think, oh, I'll read this because. But I really enjoyed entering into that male headspace and thinking about issues from their perspective. So, I mean, both books I really enjoyed. Very different, but also very similar in lots of ways. And I just think for me, the most profound experience of reading them actually is putting them alongside each other and seeing those connections of the same issues resurfacing over such a long period of time.
Yeah, they were. I think it is one of our definite successes in terms of not having to like scrabble around to find connection points. Hello, Hargreaves. So this all male environment, me and my male cat just hanging out. I think, yeah, the only criticism I really have with The Things We Never Say is that I think it's a really bad title, because it's so hard to remember. And it reminds me of like Alan Ayckbourn play titles where it could be almost anything. And yes, it is about The Things We Never Say, but I think that's a bad title to give it, because I kept looking up like The Things We Don't Say, the thing, you know, What We Haven't Said, all these different, like, what is the actual title?
I would agree. I didn't like the title, and I also wanted it to be longer. I was talking to my friend at work about it, who I lent the book to afterwards. We're both big fans, and we both said it's not her best work, and it's, I think it needed more space to breathe in places. And I also felt, uncharacteristically for Elizabeth Strout, there was an overwhelming melancholic tone to it. I think her other books tend to have a spirit of hopefulness to them, but I got to the end of it and I did feel a bit depressed, actually. And I wanted, normally I finish her books feeling like, well, you know, bad stuff happens to people, but ultimately people are good and, you know, life goes on and whatever. And, you know, sometimes we need that. And with this, especially as it was about, you know, my own profession and things, it felt a bit like I got to the end and it was like, oh, okay. So,
I'm interested you say that, because I actually felt, I did feel the hope in it. I think partly because of that relationship that Artie has with his son, the part of like that kid who did graffiti, that relationship there, and you could see it, and that girl who's got issues. I guess I could see like one-on-one personal relationships where there was hope. And I agree, like, it's a bit nihilistic, well, not nihilistic, but fatalistic over the state of the world and broader political and educational and movements.
Yeah. But
I guess I could see that hope more on a sort of, yeah, a granular level. So, yeah. And then also interesting, like, I think this is my third or fourth Elizabeth Strout, and I've never really quite understood what the fuss is about. Like, I've enjoyed them, but I know how much you love her, and I've never quite seen it. But this one, and maybe because it's the first one I've listened to rather than reading, really worked for me for the first time, where it's like, okay, I get it. I see why she's such a brilliant writer. So maybe I just need the slowness of an audiobook to really get her.
Yeah. I mean, I think that she's great and can do no wrong, so.
Well, let's do our decision making. What are you going to pick?
It's a tricky one, actually. But I think I'll go with Elizabeth Strout.
Elizabeth Strout. And I think if you picked any other Willa Cather I've read and any other Elizabeth Strout I've read, then Willa Cather would have won. But between these two, I'm also going with Elizabeth Strout.
Well, we're perfectly in agreement today.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Lovely. And let's see if we will be next time two books about, well, let's not say what they're about, because it might be a spoiler. I can't remember. But they are the one you mentioned earlier, When the Cranes Fly South by, I'm going to say, Liza Ridson. Is that right?
I would imagine so. Sounds about right.
Yeah, something like that. And Only About Love by Debbie Voisey. And we look forward to discussing them next time.
Yeah. Thanks very much for listening, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.